You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where new season, who dis? I'm your host, Justin Elmozeski, and if you're as excited about the start of Season 7 as we are, then tell a friend about this episode and our previous six seasons. Six seasons. This is the seventh season. I have no life. I have a mildly successful podcast, and I think seven seasons is a big deal. I'm going to ask Daniel a question here once I introduce him, because joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. Daniel, how many seasons has the Adam Carolla show been running?
They are going into their 10th season.
How are they considered forefathers of podcasts when we are only three seasons behind them?
I don't know, but that's right. We don't get our due in the podcast world. We give good pod, and we should be recognized for it. So we demand justice. We can see it in your eyes. You really do hate us.
How are you feeling, though, Daniel? As you're going into the seventh season, did you ever think you'd be doing this for seven seasons?
No, I didn't really know what I was doing for the first three. I assume this was some sort of weird hobby. And it kind of still is a weird hobby.
Kind of still is a weird hobby, except everyone says they have one now.
Yeah, so we went from a pod what? To, oh yeah, I've got one, in 7 short years, which seems incredible. The format of the show has changed so dramatically in the past 2-ish seasons that it seems like what we're doing now is totally different from what we were doing in the beginning, but it really is crazy. So here's to at least 7 more episodes, if not 7 more years.
That must just be you, because I feel like I've just been ranting for 7 years. I feel like I've been ranting for 36 years. It's just now I do it into a microphone. So,
but that's right. But the moment the doctor spanked you, you're like, what's the deal with Californians?
I was a little Jerry Seinfeld. No, but Daniel, I will always remember the early seasons where after we would literally record live in my kitchen I guess it was a kitchen. I can't tell out here. The apartments are so small. In Torrance, and then we would go to TGI Fridays for their happy hour with their super cheap appetizers. I will always remember that.
Good times. That was when we could both, that was the gourmet meal we could afford at the time, was TGI Friday happy hour appetizers.
That's still the gourmet meal I can afford.
Well, I've worked my way up to Olive Garden now, so.
Also joining us.
I make that Olive Garden money.
Identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green. And William,
hello.
Finally made it. How does it feel, William? For how many seasons were you just a listener?
Oh man, since the lost episodes, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. People listen to those. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The Doctor. All of those episodes, man. It's been a long time. And I've been a Patreon supporter since the very beginning as well. So,
little known fact, Midsiders, William actually pays to be on this show.
That's why I call myself executive producer of this podcast.
He actually is. He tells me a lot of shit, and I'm like, yeah, I should probably do that. And then I do it.
And much like an executive producer, we ignore you.
Exactly. Like every good executive producer.
We say, thank you for your money. Go away. Yeah. Justin, 7 years. So, I mean, how long will it take us to catch up to the number of Super Bowls that Brady will have when he retires? Is that like an infinite regression in the sense that he's just going to keep adding?
So I think we'll need to record 5 years after he retires to maybe catch up.
Maybe.
So we've got like another 10 years to go.
That's right. Although if there's someone who could win a Super Bowl in retirement, it'd somehow be Tom Brady. So.
All right. We'll get to that later. There's a lot of that talk later. You're going to be happy out there, Midsider Motive Power. But for now, you all have been waiting for us to talk about certain topics. We're going to do that in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
7 years is a long time, and we couldn't really do it without all of our amazing listeners, and especially those amazing listeners and hosts like William, who are Patreon subscribers. So if you really enjoy the show and you want to see us even do more in the future, becoming a Patreon subscriber would really help. That's patreon.com/themidside. You can check that out. We'll talk about that more later. But for now,
we have not been deplatformed yet. We have not been deplatformed yet.
That's right.
Can I just say something about the deplatforming? William, I think it was you who retweeted Prager University, Dennis Prager's channel, about how he can't advertise on Spotify now. And look, I am with you all in spirit with all of this, like, boycott all these people that are being intellectually immoral and blah, blah. But it's getting to the point now that I'm not going to be able to even get an ice cream cone at Dairy Queen. Like, where do I draw the line of, like, I need to get your services? I like Spotify.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying there, because I've thought about this a lot. Like, we've not really talked about it that much outside the show, but you know, with the whole deplatforming on Patreon and people just making up the rules, you know, I'm sympathetic to raising awareness. I'm not obviously advocating for the government to step in on any of these things. So it's a interesting conundrum, you know, and this is something we've talked about a lot in the show, about where do you draw the line? Where's the moral sanction part? And, you know, there's other alternatives to Patreon. And when there's a good one, maybe we switch up our donation platform. But at least for now, we're below the radar. So we'll keep the Patreon going until they figure us out. Until they figure out that we're way more dangerous than PragerU, way more dangerous than Jordan Peterson and Stephen Molyneux. We are way more dangerous than those guys. So until they figure that out, that's what we're going to do.
Right, and as you said, they're the best platform right now. And it's the same thing with Spotify. When you talk about pop punk, all the pop punk bands are on Spotify. So do you want me to give up my entire love for a genre because PragerU can't advertise? That's a tough, tough call for me to make. That's a value comparison, isn't it?
Yeah, it's certainly tough. But is this the news with Daniel T. Richards or the news with the other two hosts?
This is what happens. It's like I've had podcast blue balls for like a month.
Just been talking to your cats. What's the deal with California?
Yes, I do. I say it all the time, especially because Clemson just won the national title, and that's where they're from. So I'm like, guys, don't you just miss South Carolina? Don't you just miss the South? And then they think I'm crazy. Give me a treat.
Well, we talked about going under the radar. Certainly this show does. But some people who didn't go under the radar this week were the Covington High School teens, who you may have seen everywhere on the entire internet and all on mainstream media. Yes, the Covington High School teens who apparently surrounded and beat to death a Native American man with their eyes.
Wait, Laura Wagner.
With their eyes, Justin, with their eyes. Wagner.
Justin, they're all Cyclops from X-Men? All of them?
All of them. Or the black girl in the movie we're going to preview later. But we'll get there. Foreshadowing.
Wait, that was her power? I didn't understand that.
Her power was to do anything she wanted. She was omnipotent. Can I get through the news? Jeezy crazy. Oh my God. I'm not even one story in yet. Laura Wagner of Deadspin.com once says, you should believe what you saw with your own eyes. 2 days ago, she writes, a video was posted online that pretty much everyone who saw immediately recognized for what it was. Footage of white teens taunting and harassing a Native American elder named Nathan Phillips on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. What was happening was clear and unmistakable. Not just resonant, but immediately recognizable as iconic. If you wanted to compress the history of relations between the powerful and the powerless in America, or the dynamics of the current moment into a single image, you couldn't do much better than to present a white teen in a MAGA hat surrounded by a screaming horde of his peers smirking into the face of an old Native American man. Perhaps, probably, because what had happened was so undeniable it was immediately denied. Right-wing trolls not only immediately proposed that the visibly aggressive teens who were draped in the symbols of white nationalism and misogyny were in fact the aggressed upon, but began a campaign of brutal online harassment against anyone, especially journalists and especially female journalists, who accurately described what they had seen or reacted to it on the terms it deserved. It was all an enactment of the culture war tactics pioneered by Gamergate and used by Donald Trump to ascend to the pinnacle of global power. While random MAGA chuds and pepes doxed and threatened people online in an attempt to silence them and intimidate others, respectable types urged caution, proposing that it was, if you were thoughtful enough, you would perhaps realize that you hadn't in fact seen what you had just seen, or if you had, maybe it wasn't that bad at all. So Justin, she's talking a lot about the fact that the immediate response to this story was one that called these kids racist and said that they had surrounded this Native American man. And she's responding to the fact that other footage came out showing that, in fact, the kids were peaceably assembled waiting for their bus. And this Native American activist, who falsely claims to be a Vietnam vet, walked into their group and made his way into the center of their group and beat a drum in a kid's face who had the audacity to stare at him and not say anything. What actually happened, Justin? Tell us. You will be the arbiter of reality.
Oh, 2019. What happened was...
What done happened,
babe? We got our catchphrase. So last year I was saying I didn't know what the catchphrase was going to be for 2019. But I saw this story over the past 2 weeks. You said past week, but I believe it was past two. I haven't really been paying attention to social media because, as everyone who's been listening to this show knows, I've had this steady growing hatred of social media, and it's a thorn in society's side, and it makes my life worse. So I haven't been paying attention. But then suddenly I heard about like these teens and how racist they were, and I just heard rumblings about it. And then I watched the original video. And that this is why I'm saying... The catchphrase is, oh, 2019. I watched the video, and it encapsulated the headline. Believe what you saw with your own eyes. What's the headline, Daniel?
Don't doubt what you saw with your own eyes.
Okay, you know what I saw with my own eyes? A white kid standing there while a guy beat a drum in his face, and the kid's trying not to do anything so he doesn't get in trouble. He's like, how much longer do I have to put up with this shit? That's what I saw.
You know what I saw? I saw me standing there, because you know what I do when things get awkward? I have a default smile. You know how chicks are accused of having resting bitch face? I have like a slightly confused smirk. In fact,
you have resting racist face?
Yeah, that could be my new catchphrase.
William, that's called being white, isn't it?
Maybe.
that's what I learned.
I actually have that as my on my Nintendo. I have that as my me. Is just a weird smirk, because that is my default face if I'm not sure what's going on.
Well, put a MAGA hat on that me, because apparently you are smug. And that's the thing, right? Like, this story encapsulates, and I think this is going to become a theme in the news in this episode, this is like the dying fumes of social justice. It's literally just the fact that he's white and is kind of half smiling awkwardly that they've decided he's smug. That is literally the definition of racism. And the fact that they're all seeing this reality in a warped way and they're gaslighting us by telling us not to be gaslit. They're literally gaslighting everyone and then saying don't be gaslit by the people who are telling you you're being gaslit. It's fucking insane. And
yes.
It's just you can't get mad anymore. All you can do is laugh. All you can do is laugh, which, of course, foreshadows next episode. But that's all you can do is laugh. This is literally textbook witnessing the farce. Oh, 2019.
William, there is a paragraph in here, which I won't read in its entirety, but I'll read snippets of, that sort of I actually kind of agree with, but insofar as it's telling about the own author's psychology, she writes, "One lesson of the past 2 days is that you will see what you want to see here if you are determined to do so. That does not mean there is anything to be seen, but what is there? I see a frothing mass of MAGA youth who, since we're taking in all the angles here, go to school where students fairly recently wore blackface to a basketball game. We'll get there in a minute. Frenzied and yelling and out of control. I see them laughing and dancing, red MAGA hats bobbing up and down in glee. I see them yell in Philip's face, and I see he doesn't falter. I see the smugness of a group secure in its relative power over someone more vulnerable than they are. Nothing about this video showing the offensive language of black Israelites, we'll get there in a minute too, changes how upsetting it was to see the Covington students, and Sandman in particular, stare at Phillips with such contempt. So, William, I ask you if you also agree with this. Is this her, in fact, as the opening line of this paragraph says, seeing what she wants to see here, her projecting into the world the hatred and horror and nihilistic crap that is in her heart that she projects onto the world? And is that a leading enough question for you? Go.
No, it is not leading enough. It's not leading enough.
That wasn't a question.
There was a question mark in the middle.
Here's what I think. This article, this one right here that we've linked, is already the 2019 Pulitzer Prize winner. This is 100% the best representation of the media today. It is the epitome of what they do, what they try to do by publishing stories for clickbait, seeing the world through this twisted lens, through this ideological, religious lens. There's all this original sin brought in, right? Just because they're white, they have a hat on, which automatically means you can assign all of these attributes to someone just because of the way they look. There's a narrative here, a victim narrative. There's victims, and no matter what the facts are, it doesn't matter because obviously this person is a victim because he's Native American. This should win the Pulitzer Prize for 2019. We're only a couple weeks in, and this is already it.
It is certainly the best sort of naked example of primacy of consciousness that I have seen in a very long time. And for anyone unfamiliar with the phrase, it's essentially this idea that, you know, what's in my head is what is true. What I want the world to be is what it is, because I can control reality essentially by deeming it so. And as long as I get enough people to agree with me. Because as Justin alluded to, we are being gaslit by people who are telling you that you are being gaslit. And I mean that literally, because look, she says, I don't see how you could watch this and think otherwise unless you're willing to gaslight yourself and others in the service of granting undeserved sympathy to the privileged. Justin, this is social this article is an encapsulation of the actual justice part of social justice to me. She has assigned a sentence to a group. She has said, this group is guilty before I know anything else about them. It is.
Yeah, we already know they're guilty, so we don't need to discuss that part. We just need to discuss the what needs to happen next, right? How do they atone?
Weirdly, the ultimate, either how you look at it, enactment of or perversion of John Rawls's veil of ignorance, which is, I need to know nothing else about you except your race, and I can determine everything about you. And I know that you're guilty by your smirk, by your stare. To use a more pop psychology term, which will be a jumping off point, I think, for Justin, this is one of the biggest projections I've ever seen in the media.
Oh, I thought you were going to say this is madness, and I was going to say this is Sparta.
This is Sparta.
I thought that was going.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm going to – I agree with you, and I'll get to the projection thing in a second. But I'm going to one-up her, Daniel. I'm also going to look like a genius here because I'm going to say that this is woke. And the reason I know it is woke is I didn't read the article. I said that gaslighting thing because I knew what the article said. I didn't need to read the article, Daniel. And that's how long these people have been projecting. They've been projecting this so long. I know what they're going to say before they say it. I mean, I was playing this game with one of my friends, the one person I use Twitter for, a sci-fi author, and we talk about like the DCEU and everything, and we were predicting what the Aquaman reviews were going to be before they happened, and we were pretty close. They're projecting to the point that they've been projecting our entire lives. They've been projecting when they were teaching us in school. They've been projecting in the news media. We've been hearing it for so long. We don't need to read it anymore to know what they're saying.
Yeah.
You know, I think I have a theory. I have a thought experiment for you guys. Imagine it's October and it's the presidential election year and this story broke. If something like this happens in October, they are going to guarantee a Trump victory.
Yeah.
They're going to guarantee a Trump victory anyway. They're going to run Kamala Harris. Are you kidding me?
It'll be Elizabeth Warren with Kamala Harris as her running mate. Get it right. But
I want it to be Kamala Harris. You know how entertaining those debates are going to be? It's just going to be two lunatics yelling at each other.
Yeah, it's totally ridiculous. So I said we'd get to a couple things quickly. One is the side story in this, that students were wearing blackface to a basketball game, which is journalistic dishonesty to the nth degree. The Covington High School, their colors are black, and like many schools, they do a blackout game in basketball where everyone wears all black so that the whole stadium is black. That is not blackface.
And the picture I saw was the kid's entire body was painted in black too. So
yes,
it wasn't just black body. Wait, that's even more offensive. Right. It's black body.
Right.
What's that stupid horror movie? Get Out. This is some Get Out shit right here. They're taking over black bodies.
Well, that's right. South Park already did it anyway with Kyle trying to be trans black basketball player. If you remember,
yeah,
that's right.
Yep.
That's right. And the group of the part that the original video didn't show is that there was a group of other protesters who I guess are black Israelites, but I don't really know anything about that. Someone can educate me. But they were yelling things at the Covington High School kids like, "You're a bunch of children of incest," and other horrible things at them.
They were calling them fags too. They were calling the black kid and Uncle Tom and other unsavory.
So the high school kids started doing their school chant to sort of drown out the noise, and it was approximately at the end of that, after they'd all been hyped up, that this whole Phillips thing happened, which, look, high school kids made tomahawk chops and were a little snarky, a little bit, like, but Jesus H. Christ, what better behavior could you expect out of if you selected a random group of high school students from anywhere in the country, you would get exponentially worse behavior than what you saw in that video.
Can you imagine a group from like here, like in Carson High School, right over here nearby the Dale?
No!
What would have happened? Someone would have gotten shivved for sure.
Yes.
This is great, guys. I was literally about to say everything the two of you were going to say. This podcast can run without me now. It's just like I've trained everyone so well. But no, I'm actually going to make this worse. I'm going to make this worse. This is everything that's good that white culture has to offer. Yeah, that's right. I went there. A white Catholic high school, and this is how they behave. They start chanting, as Daniel's saying, they start chanting their school chant. That's how you want kids in high school to behave. This is what we teach them. You know, you're going to sit here and say your culture and our culture? Well, fine. I'm going to be collectivist for 2 seconds and say, this is how I grew up. That's what you do to taunt people. You say our school is better than your school. Or if you go to a private college and you're playing a public college, you go, state school, state school. Isn't that better than calling people faggots in other words?
Yeah, I mean, it's a step up, certainly. But I just was so incredibly shocked that it was these kids were considered to be behaving poorly. I've seen poor behavior from high school students, and this was a 0.5 out of 100 in terms of the range of bad actions for high school kids.
I'm 36 years old and I'm worse in Southern California traffic, honking my horn, flipping people off and swearing.
Certainly. I think one of the most ironic things, perhaps, again, this weird projection, primacy of consciousness thing from this article is the end of it, where essentially she says, look, these reporters need this. Maybe the Atlantic needs to do this. She says, they need to be seen as reasonable and responsible and responsive, different from the frenzied masses. If that means siding with some shithead MAGA teens and saying that 2+2=5 in the face of every bit of evidence there is to be had, so be it. What makes this unbelievable is the reference. The 2+2=5. It's a 1984 reference. And in 1984, Orwell encapsulates everything she's talking about in a short passage here when he's talking about the various crimes against the state. And he says, to wear an improper expression on your face, to look incredulous when a victory was announced, for example, was itself a punishable offense. There was even a word for it in Newspeak. Face crime, it was called. My head exploded when I saw that 2+2=5 reference. Just unbelievable. Totally,
Daniel,
totally unbelievable.
It is and it isn't. I agree with you, it's unbelievable because they clearly don't understand what they read. But that's a whole other discussion that we've had over and over again on the show, right? Like, how many times am I going to beat my head against the wall over that one? But how many times in school did leftists teach you about 1984 and say, this is what we have to avoid? They've been using these materials to teach us their point of view in school. They literally believe, I believe this, they literally believe they're the ones trying to avoid 1984, not the ones trying to make it happen. That's how insane they are.
Yeah, I mean, evil, such as it is, usually comes on the guise of this is good for you. Or this, sorry, not at all. It usually comes under the guise of this is good for us. This is good for society. This is good for the world, etc. Soon it will come under the guise of this is good for wilderness, or this is good for the bunnies in your backyard, or this is good for Gaia. But alas, and that's almost universally how we get the worst of the worst. I got to bring myself down, Justin. That 1984 thing just really got to me. I don't know why.
Well, the reason it got to you is, how much can we scream, and I don't just mean on this show, but just in general, how much can we scream, this is so obvious, before we're just like, we give up? And that's to me where you get to witnessing the farce, is when you scream it so much or it's so obvious, all you can do is laugh. The only proper reaction to the fact that they're quoting 1984 and saying this kid fucked up by having a bad facial expression and there's a face crime is just to laugh.
Because I know eventually they will have guns
all the time. Man, that's another thing. Maybe I have face crime privilege. Man,
probably.
You're white. Well, of course you do.
Someone else who committed a face crime this week.
Tom Brady. We'll get to that.
Tom Brady does definitely commit face crimes, but who else committed a face crime this week was Amazon's facial recognition software. CNET reports.
Transition. A+.
Thank you. CNET reports, this is their headline, Amazon's facial tech shows gender racial bias, MIT study says. Their facial recognition test shows bias. Okay, so how does that do it? Amazon's facial technology had a harder time recognizing the gender of darker-skinned women and made more mistakes identifying gender overall than competing technologies from Microsoft and IBM, according to an MIT study published on Thursday. Amazon's recognition software, spelled R-E-K-O-G-I-N-I-T-I-O-N, that insufferable K makes me want to stab Jeff Bezos in the toe,
find out what
incorrectly identified women as men 19% of the time, according to the study. In addition, it incorrectly identified darker-skinned women as men 31% of the time, it says. What I'm confused by here is why it didn't misidentify them 100% of the time, because it didn't ask them the preferred gender. Nonetheless, Matt Wood, general manager of artificial intelligence at Amazon Web Services, said that the study's test results are based on facial analysis, not facial recognition. Justin, we typically go to you first for questions, but I feel like we need to bring in an actual scientist to explain what the hell this is first.
Yeah, William, before like we get into analysis, can you just explain what the fuck Amazon's technology does? Like, can I sign into Amazon and they'll look at my face and tell me what I should buy? Is that what this technology does?
Yeah, so this is part of their AWS suite of services. So everything from virtual servers, networking, content acceleration, all sorts of technology storage. This is another AI is the new hot thing, and so they're starting to offer AI services. So this is part of their AI services. Recognition has two major services. The first one is analysis. So think, hey, are there faces in this picture? And tell me some basic things about the faces that it sees in that picture. The other is...
I thought that was what Facebook did.
Yeah, it is. and Facebook may use that on the back end. Who knows? So that's what Amazon provides these to is for developers to develop technologies. So this is like a piece of a puzzle that you can build on to provide some service. The other part of recognition is the facial recognition. So given a person you're looking for, is that person in this picture, right? That's a different kind of question. So the point that they're trying to make here is they weren't because the facial recognition part has been in the news because it's being used by law enforcement now. So they're making the point that that's not this. This is the facial analysis. Is there a face in this picture? And what can you tell me about it? And then now to the commentary. This wasn't even the latest version. They admit that the study was a version before the latest version, which apparently corrected all these errors. But then also, this fits in with the theme, I think, of all our stories this week. Total clickbait, right? Gender and racial bias, it was just error, pure error. It wasn't a bias, it just was a visual error in the AI algorithm. To call an AI algorithm like this racist or gender biased is crazy.
It's totally woke, and you, for not recognizing it, are part of the patriarchy, and you're a misogynist and all the rest. So get out. No. So what you're saying is that Amazon's AI is not actually racist.
That's
or
correct.
Misogynist.
It has no volition, and it is not programmed based on race. So I don't think it could be racist.
Point of order. Isn't the point of testing technology like this to make sure it doesn't make mistakes like this?
Yeah.
Isn't that why you do testing phases?
Yeah, and that's what this was.
So the headline
was a test.
Really is... Test reveals technology is imperfect as test was intended to do.
Yeah.
And test proves yet again that tests
better.
Work.
Test proves that a 19% error was corrected in the latest version of the software.
Also, this error was literally based upon lightness versus darkness, correct?
Yes.
I'm not sure, but isn't the human eye and eyesight based upon how much light there is? So logically, if something was darker and had less light, it would be harder to discern.
That
Am
is
I
correct.
Wrong?
Yeah. The error rate, I would expect the error rate to be higher if the contrast of the face was lower. So in other words, a dark features on a darker face. And also if the picture overall was darker, right? Like if it was just a low contrast in the photo overall. So this isn't surprising to me that if you have something, if you have an algorithm, if you have a trained an AI to do this facial analysis, that the earlier versions of it would struggle under these conditions. Does that make it racist?
Justin, are you saying that racism is in the eye of the beholder?
I hate you. That was good.
Thank you. It's good to be back. 2019.
But no, it's 2019. You have to say it right. Also, ladies and gentlemen, and whatever you identify as, I'm not even a scientist, and I figured that out. So there you go.
That's right. You know who else aren't scientists? Apparently, Japan's Supreme Court. who apparently, I'm not making this up, upheld a sterilization requirement for those who wish to change their gender on official documents. Yes. 2019. Okay, so here, let's break down the story a little bit more, because the headline, while true, is not
very
quite their
misleading.
Reasoning. That's
very
not what
misleading.
They're getting at. Okay, so Japan's Supreme Court has upheld a law that effectively requires transgender people to be sterilized before they can have their gender changed on official documents. The court said the law is constitutional because it was meant to reduce confusion in families and society, but it acknowledged that it restricts freedom and could become out of step with changing social values. The 2004 law states that people wishing to register a gender change must have their original reproductive organs. And for those of you who don't know, those are, this story includes a comma here, including testes or ovaries. So you know. Removed.
Are there like other things that are reproductive organs? It doesn't say testes and ovaries as if that's the entire list. It says including. So what else are there?
I don't want to know. Removed and have a body that, quote, appears to have parts that resemble the genital organs, end quote, of the gender they want to register. The unanimous decision of a four-judge panel, published Thursday, rejected an appeal by Takakito Yusui. I have no idea. A transgender man.
I love this. Keep pronouncing Japanese names. This is way entertaining for me.
Wait, what did Burrito say?
Takakito said that forced sterilization violates the right to self-determination and is unconstitutional, but the panel disagreed. So, Justin, what this law is basically saying, from what I can tell, whether or not it's right or wrong, we're just trying to get at what the actual truth is since journalists don't care, is the law is saying if you want to change your official gender on a government document, then the carpet must match the drapes. No. Then the genitalia, essentially, including your reproductive organs, must match what you're trying to register as. So I think what they're trying to get at here, whether you like it or not, and I'm not saying I like it, what they're trying to get at here is if you're actually trying to change your gender, you should be the gender you're requesting to change to, at least as closely as you can be. Nonetheless,
I think that's a little wrong. Like, I got to jump in with a little bit of Japan history here.
That's okay, because I don't understand any of this. So.
This was, you got to remember, we've shifted.
Try to bomb the harbor.
We've shifted our definitions.
Sorry. Yes, go ahead.
We've shifted our definitions of sex and gender and what transgender is tremendously in the last 5 years, right? Before, if someone was born with those rare conditions where they have, like, you know, too many sex chromosomes or not enough, and they end up having a mismatch between their genitals and, you know, who they are, that sort of physical transgender anomaly. And please, I'm not saying that as a pejorative, right, for you woke folks listening. This law comes from that time period, right, where they're saying, hey, if you're one of those unfortunate babies that are born with both and you need to change because they fucked up or you need to change, right, and you have gone through a surgery, then they're really focusing on the sex part, right? They want the sex to match. And so they're saying, hey, if you've gone through all of the work, you can change your sex, right, on the paperwork. But today we've morphed that into gender, right? Like you see that the left constantly, the social justice left constantly shift between sex and gender because to them, reality doesn't matter, right? Like sex doesn't matter. It's all a social construct. It's all in the minds of society. Right. Yeah. So it doesn't matter what the physical is, right? So I think this is another example of a completely clickbaity article. Now we can talk about like what should be the law around this. Like that's a different conversation, but like I thought this story was really interesting because it's 100% clickbait, and no one, I looked all over the web to find the history of like where did this law come from and all that stuff. I couldn't find anything to any news discussion on it. I had to go into academic discussions about it in order to find any real facts.
Okay, and that gives me another question, because when you Google Japan, they're all the news sources are using the same clickbait headline.
Yes, they are.
All
and
using
the same
the word
text
sterilization.
Almost. Yep.
Right. So can someone explain to me how sterilization comes into this? Because none of what you said says anything about sterilization. Is it just that technically if you get your gender physically changed or your sex physically changed or whatever, you're cutting yourself up so much that you sterilize yourself? But aren't there cases of, I'm trying to think of the correct terminology here, female to male transitions who then get pregnant as men. Haven't we seen stories of that? So they're not sterilized?
Yeah. I think that the confusion comes in is because when we start talking about gender, like there are some transgender folks who choose to keep their factory installed equipment, if I may say it that way, because they want to be able to procreate.
I'll allow it.
Right? And that's a complex discussion. There's people that are very moralistic about it, but like, you know, it makes sense, right? If you want to have a child someday, maybe you don't want to, you know, do too much damage to the plumbing down there.
Okay. Now I'm thinking about plumbing babies.
Mario Brothers?
Babies come out, that was a good one, but do they come out with like their diaper already halfway down their ass?
I just thought of a weird like alternative universe where there were no storks, but like your children were delivered. I don't know.
Actually, you know? Yoshi's Island, right? Isn't there a plumber Mario baby in Yoshi's Island? Isn't that part of the plot, William?
Yeah. Yeah, Stork brings that baby though.
Oh.
No. Womp womp. Nonetheless, I'm going to be the first one to admit I know very little about Japan's, one, history, two, legal system, and three, way they pronounce their names. So I'm among the least qualified people to comment on this, but I will anyway because it's our podcast. I think the concept here is Japan is trying to get some accurate account of what the reality of a given situation is, I think. And the point seems to be, basically, you can't just choose willy-nilly that you just... Horrible choice of words. You can't just choose arbitrarily that...
Willy or no willy.
You want to be a man now and change it on all of your government forms unless you've actually gone through some process in reality to make that thing happen. There's a certain amount of chaos that is caused by consistently changing your sex, although it's really gender here.
I've always said, to make it concrete, to make your point concrete, I've always brought it up in a medical context, right? Just like if you're diabetic, you wear a bracelet, right, that says you're diabetic because you want people to know, like, if you suddenly pass out, you know, that narrows down the possibilities, right? The first thing you're going to check is, oh, my God, do they need insulin, right?
Right.
But imagine you go into the emergency room and you look at the driver's license and the person is dressed like a female, has hair and maybe even breast implants, but they're male, right? Like there's different procedures that are done on you if you're male versus female. Imagine the other way around. What if you are presenting as male and you're actually pregnant, right? Right? Like there's this huge, it causes a ton of like concrete issues. Now, I say a ton. It could cause a ton of concrete issues. The amount of transgender people are so small that we don't hear a lot about it. But for those particular people, it could be a huge problem.
Yeah. So, again, I think this is a journalistic integrity thing. They're not trying to actually communicate what this is all about to us. They're trying to push an agenda, and they've figured out that this phraseology, which sounds Nazi-esque, is going to trigger a lot of people and thus push an agenda and get clicks.
Well, I have a question for you, Justin. Can we think of countries that would sterilize LGBT folks? Do we know of any in reality that actually sterilize them? Is Japan on that list?
Are you asking me that because I'm Polish?
No, I'm asking you that because you're the host.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know in World War II Germany did it. Did Japan do it too in World War II because they were allied with them?
No, but there are countries today that do it in the Middle East and in Africa.
Right, you're thinking of more Islamic countries.
Yeah.
That's why I asked if you went there because I was Polish, because I was like, yeah, fuck the Nazis, fuck Germany.
No. I've talked about this. Like, it's not even China has a problem with homosexuality, though it's a little bit more hands off now. But Like, you know, they throw gay people off roofs. What do you think they'll do to a transgender person? I'm sure they let them live and change their driver's license as often as they want, right?
This is
it's such a weird headline for Japan, right? Like, for Japan, right? Japan has its problems with racism, don't get me wrong. But and collectivism.
Fuck you, Dolphin!
But this seems like if you replace the word Japan with like Saudi Arabia, maybe I would believe it.
Yeah, this is a journalistic thing where they take an associated bad thing and put it into the headline so that the overall concept becomes bad. One of the worst I ever saw was a Richmond Times-Dispatch article about Ayn Rand, and the headline was Ayn Rand, comma, Nazi era author, comma, has new book published. And it was Ideal or whatever her new book was. Nazi era author was what they decided to put in there. Interesting. Okay.
Man, so would this podcast be described as Trump era podcast?
That's right. That's right. Also, Kim Jong-un era podcast and many other horrible things. Tom Brady cheating era podcast, for instance, according to a 10-year-old boy who won a science fair by quote-unquote proving that Tom Brady is a cheater. Okay, here's this article. By the way, I never thought I want to hit a child until I read about this child. Okay, some kids make baking soda and vinegar volcanoes for their science fair projects. Others find a way to turn their passion into a science fair project. Meet Ace Davis, a 10-year-old boy from Lexington, Kentucky, who created a science fair project about Tom Brady. While kids in New England might be trying to figure out how to scientifically prove that Brady is the greatest quarterback who ever lived, Ace decided to go in a different direction. He created a science fair project that proves that Brady is a cheater. Ace sought to prove that Brady was a cheater through science. He wanted to show that deflated footballs gave Brady a competitive advantage. On his poster, he included the results of experiments he did with his mom and sister. Each of them threw footballs of varying inflation, and he measured the distance of each one and calculated the average. He found that the least inflated footballs traveled the farthest, therefore giving Brady a competitive advantage. Of course, he included more than that in his poster, including Deflategate memes and a picture of Tom Brady crying. And for good measure, Ace added a picture of himself in his football uniform. He plays quarterback with a giant green check mark, and he put a giant red X over a picture of Brady. So he did some Q&A, which is just adorably slappable. So they asked, how did you come up with this idea for your science fair project? And he replied, because I hate Tom Brady. Good little scientist. He's been accused of cheating before. I want him to be caught. He was asked, if you could share a message with Tom Brady, what would you say to him? His reply, give me some of your money. You don't deserve it. There. Justin. He sounds like a future NIH grantee recipient. What say you?
I thought this was Cortez's NIS, sorry. Kid.
Yeah. Ocasio-Cortez's child.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, is this should we be reporting this nonsense?
I think that this should have been a Woker joke, but I think it will let me riff on another science topic. Is this the state of science education now? Where let's take out the triggering statements for that trigger Justin about Tom Brady. Let's just look at this objectively, like a scientist. He frames it with bias, right? It's not like he's saying, hey, this is a bias, and so I'm going to kind of try and control it out. That would have been a teachable moment. Science teachers chose not to do that. In fact, they rewarded him first place, right? Let's remember that as we go through this. He also did not – his hypothesis doesn't match what he tested. Now, if his hypothesis was, hey, there's this Deflategate thing. I want to answer the question, does deflating the balls help or hurt a quarterback? And then this would have been a testable hypothesis. It would be great. I would award
William,
it first place.
William,
then.
You say that, but fifth grader Javion Morgan of Sevierville, Tennessee, got first place in his school science fair for answering exactly that question, and he came to the conclusion that Tom Brady's innocent.
Wait, we can't have competing science. Yeah. That's not how science works.
Oh, well,
but do you guys see what I'm saying? Like, this, all of this would have been a teachable moment, and they've instead taught this person, this child, that science is about taking your bias and making random facts and then saying, therefore, my bias is correct. This is terrifying, right?
It's deeper than that, William. They were okay with it because he was doing hatred of the good. That's what it fundamentally goes down to.
This is terrifying. As a former Shiawassee County, Michigan science fair winner, for when I was about this age, do you know what I did for my experiment? I remember in fifth grade, I failed miserably. I tried to do something with pulleys, and I didn't get it to work. I didn't have a good hypothesis. My pulleys didn't work right. It was bad, but I took all that feedback. My science teacher, I had the same teacher for fifth and sixth grade, took all that feedback. I was like, okay, next year I'll have a better experiment. The next year I grew grass. I know, sounds super boring, but I put different filters, colored filters on top. And I even had a control, cause I had read about like how scientists need a control. So I had a very light yellow one and then a green and a red and a blue. And then I tested, well, what color light is like, does the grass actually need to grow? And that's the year I won. Why? Because the first year I failed, but all the feedback I was given about like what a control was, you know, how to set up the experimental method. Now, these are all words I didn't know as a fifth grader, right? It wasn't explained to me like that. But now that I'm more mature in engineering knowledge and scientific knowledge, I understand that's what they were teaching me. They were teaching me how to make a good hypothesis, how to make a good control, how to set up a decent experimental method. Great learning experience for me. This kid should have failed this time. And been able to teach those lessons. Instead, he's learning that science is about bias, which I guess is true. You joked about it. I guess if he's a future NIH grant recipient, this is exactly what it's about nowadays.
But Tom Brady is a cheater, so he got to the right conclusion, obviously.
Yeah, you pick your conclusions a priori and then have mold the data to fit it.
You know what I just remembered, William, because you said that? I actually did a science fair project on air and balls. I can't believe this.
No.
Yes. So in soccer, people always complain that the ball isn't inflated enough because they claim that if the ball is less inflated, it goes further. So I did an experiment where I'm not making this up, where I kept inflating the balls and seeing if they went further when they're more inflated. And I did it to the point that one of the balls exploded and they thought I set a bomb off in the school.
Was that because you were white?
No, but this is how you want to know how different the world was back then? They ran in there and they were like, what happened? I was like, oh, I accidentally blew up the soccer ball. And they were like, oh, okay. We thought there was a bomb. I was like, nope. And then they all walked away.
There would have had to have been crisis counselors if that had happened in school today.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was, how ahead of the curve was I, man? My entire life. My entire life. Oh, 2019.
You're actually the real life River Song.
Yeah. So the Facebook post where the father is bragging, I guess, about his son, essentially all he's doing is using hashtags to try to get his son on late night television.
Yeah.
Hashtag yeah. Ellen DeGeneres. Hashtag
I'm
the
sure,
Ellen Show.
I'm sure that wasn't planned at all.
Hashtag Tonight Show, hashtag Jimmy Kimmel, hashtag thankful, throw that one in there, hashtag Jimmy Kimmel Live. So I wonder, you know, this is all an elaborate bit of nonsense, right? This can't really be what they're teaching in science now, could it? Could it possibly be the state of education as bad as it is?
Yes.
No,
I'm telling
it's the
you,
parent
no.
had an agenda. The teacher didn't want to fight. The teacher shared the agenda. I really believe this comes down to hating Tom Brady and the Patriots. I really do. That's what it comes down to.
I definitely see this as a pattern of the downgrading of science. We already see it in college with the invasion of the SJWs, requiring quotas for women in physics and all sorts of other crazy things. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy. I'm just saying that this is similar to that pattern.
But like, what is the root purpose of doing all of that? The root purpose of doing all of that is taking from the people who are able and giving it to the people who are not able.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
That's all. That's the root purpose. So this kid goes, oh, Tom Brady doesn't deserve this because he's great. I deserve it because I suck. Oh, great. He's come to the right conclusion.
Well, maybe I should.
As Daniel was saying.
Maybe I should draw a conclusion here. Maybe I should draw a conclusion that there were no experiments at this science fair that used a control or had a valid hypothesis or that drew a conclusion that follows from the data.
Maybe this was the best one. Kentucky. Valid hypothesis.
Yeah. You said the word science. Congratulations.
It's what Daniel
You had
said.
A table. You must be doing science.
As long as he got to the conclusion he needed to, it didn't matter what his data and methods were. That's right. The world these people live in.
Yeah. It's total nonsense.
One more thing. Does anyone see the connection between this story and the first story? They have a narrative, and no matter what reality is, therefore their narrative is true.
Well, that's right. Tom Brady's smug, therefore.
Oh yeah, that too. He wears a hat that triggers people.
Guys.
Look at all the parallels between the first and
the
fourth story.
Back to my most epic rant ever. This goes back to the Deflategate rant I made years ago. It goes back to that. I was saying this shit then. Come on now.
Yep.
You're gonna piss me off.
That's the point of this show, I thought.
Yeah, I know. But yes, I mean, the smug thing wasn't the Tom Brady thing. When he made the video of him and Gronk on Instagram, where they were leaving the AFC Championship game and Gronk had his AFC Champions gear on, and the song was saying, "We ain't going nowhere," and they're just smiling. And then people the next day were like, "Oh, Tom Brady's smug." I was like, that's it now. That's it. If I smile and I'm white, I'm smug. That's it. That's the new coded language. You can't be successful in white now or you're smug. Tom
Brady's
right, the least smug human being on the planet. The dude's been to the Super Bowl 9 times and he still acts like, hopefully we win. He literally said that at the rally. He goes, hopefully we win. And it really stuck out to me. He wasn't even like, we're going to win. The dude's won the Super Bowl 5 times and this is his ninth time going and he still says, hopefully. And you're going to call the motherfucker smug? Fuck you. Now I'm pissed off.
What a great time to go into your segment.
This was the last story?
That was it.
That was it, dude.
See, I'm so distracted. I'm so flummoxed that, So let's just do it. It's time for The Hope for Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio.
If you, dear listener, are not in our Discord channel, you should join it. I'm finally getting back on the horse, finally reading more of The Fountainhead, and in there I will be giving my observations of what I think should appear in the Fountainhead movie. I was just having a discussion via text the other day with Midsider Michael about Chapter 2 and how I think my mind's escaping me. Who's the bad Francone? How Francone giving the graduation speech would be a great visual image. It would tell a lot of the story. It would get a lot of the exposition done. So you get more observations like that. Join our Discord channel. We have the link on every episode page, on the midside.com. And if you don't know, you can just message one of us or message it on Twitter. I do get social media notifications. I just don't read feeds. So I will respond to you personally.
And if you're a Patreon supporter, you get special access to secret channels. And maybe coming soon, you might be able to listen live as we record the podcast if you're a Patreon member. So be sure to check out our Discord. And if you haven't already, link it to your Patreon so you can get access to all the secret channels in our server.
I believe that Midsider Michael is listening in now because we're testing now the functionality of it. Midsider Michael, if you are listening in, send me a text message and I will reply to it on air and it'll be like magic.
Oh, man. Next thing you know, we'll be taking callers. Caller's from Canada.
He just said, still here. He said it instantly. Still here. Look at that, ladies and gentlemen. You can be part of this one day.
Still here.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Was that a...
Oh, come on! You didn't get that? Jesus.
Please tell me, Michael, was that on purpose, still here? Fan. Yep, it was on purpose. I love you all. It's Super Bowl week. I am so happy right now. And let's talk about something else that made me happy. Still here. Still here. Something else that made me happy. Glass. Did either of you see M. Night's latest movie, Glass?
I did not. I was waiting to get a review from someone I trusted, and one of my friends went and saw it and said that he liked it, and he gave me some good reasons. So I've heard good things.
Okay.
Not interested.
Not interested. You still are mad about The Water and Signs.
I'm still mad about The Happening.
I'm still mad about Avatar The Last Airbender, so...
Well, I mean, yes. That is legitimately a terrible movie, but...
Aliens invading a planet that's 80% the most deadly thing to them was a little bit of a ridiculous move, but...
What if they had nowhere else to invade?
Nowhere else in the entire universe? Nowhere?
What if they needed humans in particular?
None of that was set up. All that was set up is that the thing they're running around in a cornfield, which is like 90% humidity... is the deadliest thing to them that could possibly hurt them. I just forget it.
I would agree with you if the movie were not about faith. You're just supposed to take it on faith. You're just supposed to take it on faith.
That's right. Bend over and take it on faith.
What you're pointing out are problems with religion. Anyway, this movie is M. Night's best work. So it is the end of the trilogy started in Unbreakable. Have you at least seen Unbreakable, either of you?
Nope.
Yeah, I recently rewatched it because I was preparing in case I wanted to go see Glass. So I rewatched Unbreakable, but I have not seen Split.
Okay, Unbreakable is the amazing movie about Bruce Willis learning that he's actually a superhero. Split is the secret sequel to that movie where James McAvoy is a supervillain. And then Glass is the follow-up of that where in the trilogy, in the movie, David Dunn, Bruce Willis's character, James McAvoy's character and Samuel Jackson's character are put in a mental institution together. Now, this is really, really tough for me to not spoil it because it's actually very relevant to a lot of things we talked about this episode. So, because William's going to see it, so I can't talk about it. But what I'm going to say is...
We need the spoiler alert drop.
Do you want to do a spoiler alert drop? Or, I mean, are you going to listen, William?
Yeah, I'll listen, but do the spoiler alert. I'll see it. I'll see it when it comes out on Netflix.
All right, Daniel, do you care?
Never going to see it.
Okay, so in the movie, the three of them are brought to this mental institution, and they're told by this doctor, this female doctor, which I believe is intentional, that they have a delusion. And because they've been through certain experiences and they have a certain brain condition, they are convinced that they have abilities that other people do not have. And this is a delusion, and they need to be convinced out of it. Turns out at the end of the movie that she was just gaslighting them. She is part of a conspiracy that is trying to eliminate all superheroes from the world whenever there is an outbreak. Because if they become superheroes, then other people will start to unlock their abilities and their control over the world will be lost. The end of the movie is Samuel Jackson's character Glass was able to film the final confrontation between Bruce Willis's character and James McAvoy's character where they're demonstrating their superpowers and then are then killed by the conspiracy and send that video out to people and it goes viral. And the end of the movie is seeing that going viral with his voiceover on it where he says, belief in oneself is contagious. And essentially the whole point is never let them tell you that you aren't special and you don't have abilities. It is exactly the movie that we need right now.
This is M. Night Shyamalan speaking.
Yeah.
Yes. Tremendous, tremendous, tremendous. And it very much comes across that way, yes, like the Galt speech. And you've seen this in his earlier work as well. And I believe, to a large extent, that's why people have destroyed him. Yes, he had a couple bad movies, other people who had bad movies too, but his career was literally destroyed. Did you know that movie, The Visit, he self-financed? he took out a $5 million loan to make the found footage horror movie The Visit. And then based off on the money he made off of that, he made Split. And then based upon the money he made off of Split, he made Glass. He is literally a self-made filmmaker at this point because they tried to destroy his career and now he is at this point. So it's a very almost personal movie at this point because this is the trilogy he promised he would make years ago and we never thought we'd see.
So you should see this movie if
you like good movies. No, I mean, if you're a big M. Night fan and you like M. Night when he's at his best, and I'm talking about Unbreakable, Sixth Sense, The Village. I love The Village. If you like those kind of movies, you're going to love this movie. If you love Split, Split's tremendous. See Split, see Glass. Don't see this if you like the typical naturalistic crap and if you need everything to be brilliantly shot. I mean, look, he has some brilliant stuff visually, but also some of his stuff is kind of boring visually. You can tell he's not a big-time Hollywood director. It's not a big budget. If you're used to these big-budget films and you're looking for everything to be a Zack Snyder visual, you're going to be disappointed. But you have to understand he's more of an intellectual Twilight Zone-type director. All right, I don't know if the spoiler drop will be in there, but you'll hear me say spoiler like 8 times. So, but let's move on, and let's spoil some other things that are going to come out. We're going to do trailer takedown here. And again, if you go to themidside.com/podcast, you can watch the trailers at any point. You can watch it before you listen to the episode. You can watch it after you listen to the episode. You can alternate. We talk about a trailer, you watch the next one. We talk about a trailer, you watch the next one.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
The Lego Movie 2, the second part, is exactly what it sounds like. It's the second part of the Lego Movie, and in it, and this is something that's confusing to me, and maybe Daniel, you can describe it to me. They look like, even though they won in the first movie, they're living in a post-apocalypse. It's very confusing to me. But then aliens come down and kidnap Lucy, I think her name is, the cool female character who's in love with Emmett, and then they have to go into space to try and get her back, and then that's the plot of the movie. But I can't understand, like, if they're in a post-apocalyptic world or not. This seems to have a lot of the same comedy as the first one, the same style, the very meta-ness of it. I really appreciated the joke of Chris Pratt's character going into space and meeting basically an amalgamation of every one of Chris Pratt's characters. I appreciated that. I appreciated that there was less Lego Batman in this trailer, that they could have really gone in that direction and they didn't. I see no reason I wouldn't also enjoy this movie as much as I enjoyed the Lego Movie, which was brilliant. So they did a good job of sustaining their audience. Hug. Daniel?
No need to wait. Definitely a hug. For me, the first one was good. This one looks to be on par. There are some plot elements. I don't know what the hell happens. I don't have an answer for you. It does appear that they're in some post-apocalyptic world. In fact, she says, everything used to be awesome, and now everything's not, or whatever
she says. I like that line, too. That was a funny line.
Yeah. And then Chris Pratt's character comes up, smiling with coffee. So something happened. We don't know what it is, and now they're fighting. It was essentially what appears to be his sister, I'm assuming? But
I have confirmation from Midsider Michael that it is in fact a direct continuation from the end of the first movie, where his sister is controlling Duplos to fight him, the original human boy, and his characters.
Yeah, there you go. So, sounds good. I'll watch it. Hug.
William?
Yeah, I like the trailer. I laughed, so that is a ringing endorsement for me for comedy, so I will see it. Hug.
Second trailer.
Fast Color is a movie that I don't know how is not offensive on like 8 levels, especially because am I the only one who picked up that this was made by whatever the production company is, Code Black sub label or whatever? And I was like, did they make a production house to make just black people movies called Code Black? Is that's not racist? Are we social justice now? We can be racist but not racist. So in this movie, it looks like someone's trying to recreate Unbreakable, where they're like, hey, what if we did a movie about people who had superpowers in a realistic world, except one's really fast and one can see colors and they're all black women. So wait, what's the hook of this movie? They're black women. What? There was actually, it came up in the trailer where someone was like, pure black girl magic. That was like the review. What about this has anything to do with race besides the fact that they happen to cast black women in it? Can someone explain this to me? This looks like terrible trash. Tackle.
Studio pitch. What if we remade Powder but with a black woman? Tackle.
I struggle to put together... I'm so desperate for good sci-fi. I struggle to put together what this is even about. Am I just supposed to fill in all the blanks? Like, I don't want my hand to be held, but at least help me figure out what this is about. I have no idea what this is about. Tackle.
Third trailer.
The beach bum also doesn't make any sense. So it starts out, it's in Venice Beach, and it's Matthew McConaughey playing a beach bum. Then it seems like he's a musician or something, and I'm like, okay, fine, we're gonna just portray the life of a musician who's always high, blah blah blah. Then you see Snoop Dogg and you're like, okay, is he playing himself? This movie is about drugs. Okay, I get it. And then all of a sudden he's like, I'm gonna write the great American novel. What? Where did that come from? There was no indication prior that he was a writer. And I was like, I am completely out of this movie. And then Zac Efron showed up and I said, fine.
You're really going to see this movie based on Zac Efron?
I probably will not ever make the time to see this movie. But if somebody was like, hey, we're going to watch that movie with Matthew McConaughey, Snoop Dogg, and Zac Efron, I would just be like, fine. Tackle.
I think that makes you a little more gay than you were at the beginning of this show. Just a little. Just a little bit. A little bit more. This looks like horrible naturalistic crap, and I'll never watch it, and I don't know why Matthew McConaughey picks this kind of role. So, tackle.
Let's make Big Lebowski 2 before Big Lebowski 2 comes out. Tackle.
Final trailer.
High Life continues the theme of movies that don't make any fucking sense in the trailers, and our sci-fi that William will be reaching to make some sense of. It seems like they're trying to make it so humans can have babies in space. Can humans not have babies in space? Is that like a thing? Like, is the gravity so bad, or the lack of gravity so bad, the baby would develop deformed? I don't know the science behind this, but the entire trailer is like, seems to be saying, oh, if you play God and you try to have a baby in space, you're evil. Doesn't really say why. Like, wouldn't that be a good thing if we could have babies in space? It's got the guy who played the vampire in Twilight. Tackle.
Daniel.
Anything described as a sexy space thriller? Not really into. I also didn't really get what was going on. I will say that the cinematography and the directing looks outstanding. But to go to your point earlier about M. Night, movies not really looking like that. You can have all the budget in the world. If you have a crap script, a crap plot, I don't care how good it looks. I don't want to see it. Tackle.
Right, and M. Night's like the inverse of that, right? Like he's a brilliant, brilliant writer and an above average director. So you're like, you excuse the directing a little bit when it doesn't get as good, especially with the self-financed budgets at this point. You go, oh, okay, you know, this was a really good script and this was really intelligent. This is a story worth telling. Whereas with this one, you don't know what's going on, and then they say it's sexy, and you're like, does this director even understand? Does this writer even understand what sexy is? Or how perverse is the reviewer that called it sexy? Like, can you imagine being in a relationship with that person? Hey, so tonight I want to role play like we're trying to have a baby in space, but that makes us evil. What?
So I was also extremely confused by this, so I decided to read one of the reviews that I could find, and they were just as confused after watching the film. It's about a deranged fertility doctor come warden with a cascading black mane who was herself incarcerated for murdering her children. This is sci-fi sort of like dressing and just pure naturalism on the storytelling. Random elements put together. It's told in stream of consciousness. Hell no, I am out. Tackle.
Well, 2019 is not looking too good for movies now, is it?
Legos.
That about sums it up. But you know what it is looking good for? Football. Let's talk about the Super Bowl in a special edition of Belichick Your Premises.
Talk to the geniuses that are online. What was the condition to rule and control? The media sells it, and you leave the role. Mental wounds still screaming, driving me insane. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train.
Recorded live a week before the Super Bowl, it's time to Belichick Your Premises. I wish I could say that as we were recording this, they would be giving out the Lombardi Trophy next week, but the game takes way too fucking long because all the commercials and everything. Isn't actual game time like 5 hours, Daniel?
Yeah, it's ludicrous. Commercials was a 30-minute halftime. It's a completely different kind of game with the pacing that you have to play.
Right, and we obviously saw that with the Atlanta Super Bowl, the 28-3 comeback. Belichick understands that more than anyone, and he—that's how they beat Atlanta. He used that against them. But before we get to all this discussion of this game against the Rams, the Patriots against the Rams, I just want to thank everyone who participated in the Championship Sunday Belichick Your Premises live streams. If you stuck around for the whole thing, you got to see the payoff of me going nuts when we won the game. I think we'll do another one next week for the Super Bowl, and maybe you will see a similar payoff. And that is what I want to discuss with you, Daniel. And William, you can obviously give your perspective as well. But I want to talk to you, Daniel, because as we've mentioned many times before, you are a newer Patriots fan, right? I've been around my whole life. I've seen all the Super Bowls. I've seen the futility before the Super Bowls. But you are newer. So correct. For me, I'm getting a sense right now. So I want to talk about the Patriots before we talk about the game and what people are saying about it. I'm getting a sense right now, a feeling of this doesn't feel like it's felt for a long time. This game very much feels like the first Super Bowl. And what I mean by that is I sent you guys the video of the rally. 20,000 fans showed up. That's the most that have ever showed up to the rally. This feels like we care more. The fans care more. The team care more. It feels like this game means more to us than ever before. And to me, it's starting to feel like what it was in that first Super Bowl or the first couple where it was like, yeah, we're going to win this. We're going to prove things. And this is going to be amazing. And we're going to be the best team in the world. And it's us against the world. It feels like that again. Are you getting that different sense of a feeling? I mean, at least feels different from last year where we were like, yeah, it's a Super Bowl again. We'll probably beat the Eagles. But is this just something that I can only have as an experience if I've been there from the beginning? Or are you getting that sense as well?
I'm getting that sense, and I think it comes from two times when things are particularly consequential. And those two times are the sort of first time or beginning times. It doesn't have to necessarily be first, but beginning times and then end times. Now, that's a little bit depressing, and I don't mean to say that this is the last Super Bowl for Tom Brady. He, in fact, today said there was 0% chance he would retire, whether or not he won or lost. He said that today. But there is a sense that things are coming to a close in some way, and so there's a heightened sense of urgency. And in fact, that urgency is even more heightened when every commentator in the universe keeps saying this is the end of the dynasty and has been saying it now for two seasons or three seasons. At some point, the dynasty will come to an end, but that makes every single one of these opportunities almost, if not exponentially, maybe logarithmically or something, increasingly more and more fulfilling and satisfying and like, yes, we can do it again. We can do it one more time. You know, screw all these people. Screw the analysts who aren't looking at, you know, the ultimate statistic, which is wins. you know, screw everyone who said this is a cliff. Screw everyone who said that that blowout to the Chiefs was the end of the dynasty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's because there is a finality to it all at some point. So the middle is usually the thing where people are sort of like, it's sort of like, okay, fine, whatever. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I think we got a big scare with that this season, with the weird loss to Miami and then losing in Pittsburgh like that. I know that that destroyed me. I thought, like, holy crap, we never lose to Pittsburgh like this. These two things never – we never have two games in a row like this. And I literally feared that that was it, because when those things start happening, that's when the end is near. And I do think that probably foreshadows in maybe, you know, in Brady time, which is like – five extra seasons than it should be, maybe three seasons down the road. Those are the first sort of cracks in the armor, if you will. But I think that kind of galvanized us as a fan base, especially as you said, everyone saying we couldn't do it. Everyone saying we couldn't win in Kansas City, and then getting mad at us for saying we were underdogs, right? For embracing the fact that they said we couldn't win. Then that's, I think it sort of created an us versus them mentality.
Yeah, it does. And it would with any fan base, but Belichick and the sort of New England culture has been such that he knows how to leverage that in a way that is maybe, you know, top three most masterful things he could possibly do as a leader of human beings. So it has been remarkable to witness.
He's passed that ability on to Brady and Edelman as well. I mean, we saw it with Brady with the thumb injury. Was that was last year, right? The thumb injury?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the thumb injury last year, they did the same thing. And then Brady and Edelman did it this year with, I mean, Brady's video to Gronk. You don't think that was intended to fire up his teammates and all of Patriots Nation? Edelman's t-shirt, a bet against us. You don't think they knew what they were doing with those shirts?
Did you watch the video of Edelman firing up Brady in the game by screaming at him, "You're too old"?
I sent that to you. That's where you saw that. That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. He comes out of the game and he's like, "Nice pass, baby. Nice pass, baby." And then he just starts yelling at him, "You're too old. You're too fucking old." It's just the funniest thing in the world, because that is, like, to me, that is masculinity at its purest form. And what by that is
so toxic.
They would say it's toxic, right? Because it's vulgar, it's aggressive.
Toxic to the Chiefs.
It's actually, exactly. Exactly.
Oppressing the Native American. We've started the episode, and now we're ending the episode.
With smugness, the smugness of a white man attacking a Native American. Yeah. No, and they would say it's toxic. Even their friendship, their relationship, they would say is toxic. But that is a very loving thing in that moment, and that's why it's hilarious. Him taking the words that are being used against Brady and saying it to him as they're being said, but saying it ironically, is that shows the depth of trust and understanding and love they have for each other. And it's amazing. And that's why people go, well, how on that in the fourth quarter against the Chiefs, how can they keep throwing the ball down the middle of the field like that on third and 10 and catching it? And the Chiefs don't get it. How the Chiefs don't stop it. How do they keep converting? Because of that. Most people see that and they don't see that's connected, but that's how it works. If you can yell you're too fucking old at someone who everyone in the world is saying they're old, and he gets that you're saying he's not old and he can keep doing it, you've reached another level of your relationship and of human existence, to be honest. It was beautiful and hilarious.
Yeah. It was remarkable to see overall. In terms of actual football here, what do you think of the matchup against the Rams?
So I was actually going to ask you, but I'll go first since you asked me. Here's the thing. I said before the playoffs, and Midsider Michael can vouch for this, and I'm sure I'll get a text here in 2 seconds because he's listening in. I said before the playoffs, Belichick did something that I think was really fucking brilliant that nobody realizes how brilliant it is, and they're not going to realize it until after the game. He saw who the best teams in the playoffs were. The best teams, Daniel, were the Chiefs, the Saints, and the Rams. Any argument?
No, not at all.
I would also maybe put the Bears on there, but their Trubisky is sort of like Jay Cutler, where he throws a shitload of interceptions. So they're probably not on the same level. But you look at those three teams, and they all have one thing in common. They have a high-powered offense, and a sort of middling defense, with maybe the Rams having the best defense out of the three, maybe. So what did Belichick do? How do you beat a high-powered offense, Daniel? How do you beat a high-powered offense and middling defense? What type of team do you create?
You create a run-heavy team that eats up the clock and keeps that offense off the field.
With a strong defense, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. Of course, but...
And what did Belichick create?
You don't even need to have a... The point is, you don't even need to have a strong defense. You need to have a defense that, again, will that can allow plays, but it can't allow touchdowns.
That's right. As long as you don't give up the big play, you're fine.
Yes.
So what did Belichick do? What type of team did he create?
That's the exact type of team he created, and he had to create it mid-season, which is what's crazy about it.
Don't you think he did that on purpose? Don't you think he knew what he was doing? I mean, don't you think he knew what he was doing when he was drafting Sony Michel? Look, I think what happened is Belichick is very good at seeing the trends in the league and adapting his team and his drafting and the players he's signing to beat out those trends. Right? He changes his team before everybody else does because he knows it's a copycat league and he knows where everything is going. And football has been going recently to super high-scoring games with no defense. So if you know that, what type of team do you build? You build a team that can slightly slow down the other team's defense just enough so you can score enough points to win the game. What did he build? He built
that's
that.
What he built.
I don't think, unless Sean McVay is on another level that Belichick's on, I don't think McVay, and I don't think that team is built to beat this team for the Patriots, because I think that Belichick went to another level this year. That's why I think it doesn't make sense to people, and they're saying they're less skilled and this team isn't as good, and that's why the analysts are again, you know, starting to say the Rams can win. And that's why I think the Patriots have the advantage in this game. Does that mean they will win? No, it all comes down to execution on the field, and anything can happen on any given Sunday. Shaq Mason blows a block, there's a strip sack, and the Patriots can't score, you lose the game. That's what happens. It all comes down to execution on Sunday. But I don't think McVay is able to adapt his roster. I think that Rams went all in on the current style of play that Belichick was anticipating, which is the score lots of points all the time and have a middling defense. And they went all in on that with free agents and trades, and they got to the Super Bowl based on it. They did what they needed to win in the NFL now. And that's been doing well for a lot of people. But who have they been coming up against? Belichick and the Patriots. So this is the same story of the league that's been going on for years. I mean, it's ironically the same story against the Rams in the first Super Bowl. They were the greatest show on turf. They used the rules at that point to start the era of the high-flying offense. To start that. And here we are back here again. With a team, with Patriots team that doesn't have as high powered of an offense and has more of a defensive run minded team with a quarterback that people say can execute as well, but is very good at game management playing that high powered offense. It's like the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I feel very confident going into this game because you can even ask William. When I was watching the NFC game, and people saw this on the feed if you were watching, I sat there and I went, this is bad. Whoever wins the AFC is going to beat either of these teams. I would have been confident it was the Chiefs. I'm confident it's the Patriots. But what I want to ask you, Daniel, is people have started, and I've seen this argument, comparing the Rams to the Eagles from last year. They have an above-average defensive line. They have a quarterback that's inconsistent but has moments of brilliance. They have a good running game. And they're saying, oh, that's what beat the Patriots last year. It's what will beat the Patriots again. Is that a valid argument? Is that something to be afraid of? Or is this people grasping for straws because they don't want a sixth Super Bowl coronation? Because if the Patriots win, they're inarguably the greatest franchise of all time.
Maybe some comparison, but the Eagles' defense last year is much better than people gave them credit for, and even though the Patriots put up 33 points on them, it wasn't enough. Obviously, it's 33? Yeah. But also remember that the Patriots' defense from last year, I don't think was anywhere near as good as the Patriots' defense from this year. So there's that distinction. But Nick Foles, Jared Goff, very different players. Jared Goff is not the kind of inconsistent player that Nick Foles is. Nick Foles holds the record for most touchdowns in a game, and he's tied the record for most consecutive completions in a game, and yet he's mostly a backup who will probably be terrible to whatever team he goes to next year. Remember, he was a starter for a while and was terrible, because he is wildly, wildly inconsistent. Jared Goff has moments of inconsistency, but for the most part, you know exactly what you're going to get with Jared Goff. He has occasional flashes of being a good quarterback, but he is a very consistent quarterback who tends to not make horrific mistakes. I think that's the thing that McVay has essentially coached him up on, is do what's required and don't make horrific mistakes and we'll win more games than we lose. I don't think that kind of quarterback matches up well with the kind of defense Belichick has put together this year. So I'm pretty confident. Obviously, McVay is hailed as this new Belichick up-and-coming genius, and he could come up with some scheme that totally decimates the Patriots. It's possible, because we live in reality. I just don't think it's probable. But maybe I end up eating my shoe after next week.
Well, and then even if he comes up with that, will he be able to continue to adjust throughout the game? Right? Because the Falcons came out with something that totally decimated the Patriots, but they couldn't keep up for it through the entire game.
Yes, absolutely. A full 5 hours of football. I want to go back, when we end the segment, I want to go back about the coaching decision that not many people are talking about that decided the AFC Championship game. Justin, do you have a guess about the single one coaching decision that decided the game?
Does it have to be by Belichick?
No.
Yeah, it was Andy Reid deferring on the kickoff.
100% correct, Justin. No one is really talking about this. I've watched a bunch of analysis because I'm obsessed right now with the Patriots. No one is really talking about this. Andy Reid is sort of known for blowing it in big moments, but how Andy Reid wins the coin toss and then gives the ball to Tom Brady is not Andy Reid blowing it in a big moment. He had a week to prepare for that. He had a week to sit in a room with smart people and essentially say, if we win the coin toss, what do we do? You have one of the most explosive quarterbacks in the league, and you put him on the bench for 10 minutes at the beginning of a game after watching what the Patriots did to the Chargers. That is not a blunder of a coach. That is not a clock management mistake. That is a Andy Reid will never make it big kind of mistake, because that is basic strategy that you have to have in order to win. I think, Justin, if the Chiefs possess the ball for 3 more minutes in that game, they probably win. 3 minutes. I think they win the game.
Hard to say with counterfactuals like that. You know I hate arguing counterfactuals, but the point remains that I asked somebody, it might have been Midsider Michael, but I asked, I go, did we win the coin toss? Because it didn't make sense to me that if they won the coin toss, they would give us the ball, because I knew the Patriots' strategy. As we've been saying this entire episode, this entire segment, run the ball, eat up the clock, keep the offense off the field. That's what they did to the Chargers. I knew that's what Belichick said. If we get the ball, we need to get the ball first, score first, and eat up the clock. You knew that had to be the Patriots' strategy. And what blows my mind, Daniel, what blows my mind is, I know it. You know it. Belichick knows it. There have to be other people who know it. Or the other conclusion is just we're on the same level of Belichick at this point, which I'm not comfortable saying. How can we know better than Andy Reid? Do you get what I'm saying? Is it just because we follow the Patriots that much?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It blew my mind at the time. I thought that the Patriots had won the toss. I learned after the game that Andy Reid won the toss. Just totally nuts.
And we both derived this independently, so I can say that I taught you well, Daniel.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, William's here.
Yeah. William, what do you have to say about the AFC Championship game, your awkward reaction to me going nuts on the feed?
I think the live stream went well. We had some great participation. I don't know. I think we should do score predictions. I have a score prediction for you guys. I think it's going to be 31-20 Patriots. I think the Patriots are going to execute on their game plan, and they're going to the defense is going to bend and not break, and that's what it's going to be.
I don't really do score predictions. I don't like them. I'm with you because I think that if you look at the stats, since the wide receiver for the Rams, Cup, went down during the season, I think it was week 10, maybe week 11, Jared Goff has not done as well.
And ruined my fantasy league. Yeah.
Did you have him in your fantasy league?
I did, yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, what week was it, 10 or 11?
It was 10, yeah.
10, okay. So since he went down, Jared Goff has not done as well. Now, if you look at their other wide receivers, they have... don't they have a Clemson guy? I thought Sammy Watkins was on the Chiefs, wasn't he? Who's the Clemson guy on...
Mike Williams. No, that's...
No, it's Chargers.
Chargers.
Somebody looked that up for me. They have a Clemson receiver, I believe, and they also have Brandon Cooks. But as we know from his experience with the Patriots, Brandon Cooks does not perform in big games. He knocked himself out of the Super Bowl last year. Likewise, on the defense, Aqib Talib does not perform in big games. We've seen that with the Patriots. How many times did he let the Patriots down in big games? The only time he did well in a big game was when Von Miller carried the load for the Denver Broncos all the way to the Super Bowl championship that year, when even Talib just disappeared into the mist at that point, into the abyss. So what I think is going to happen in this game is I think Belichick's going to let him run the ball. I think they're going to say, oh, you think C.J. Anderson's the hot star? Oh, go ahead. You run the ball. Because if you run the ball and we run the ball, and then it comes down to it at the end, and you're going to have a tight score with Sony Michel versus C.J. Anderson and Tom Brady versus Jared Goff, I'm going to take Tom Brady every time, and I think that's going to be the difference in the game. Even if Todd Gurley is healthy and runs a lot, if we've got our running back going over 100 and their running back going over 100, the Patriots win. That's what I think is going to happen. I think we're going to see a run-heavy Super Bowl because I think Belichick's going to game plan into that for the Rams. He's going to say, okay, you go ahead, run the ball, take the ball out of Goff's hands, run the ball, and we're going to run the ball. And I think that that's going to favor the Patriots, and that's what I think is going to happen. Daniel?
24-17 Pats.
You guys are all ballsy. I don't do score predictions. I don't like them. Do you have a strategy prediction?
Everything you said.
All right, then. I think that sums it up. Thanks for checking in with us. And for now, we're on to Super Bowl 53.
My face, your face, instant face. Go talk to whoever you want that does that
stuff. All right, gentlemen, what did we learn this trip? William?
I learned that all I need to do is just state my narrative and draw the conclusion that fits my narrative. I do not need to actually be objective about anything.
Daniel?
I learned that AI is racist. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned what our catchphrase is for this year. Oh, 2019.
Well, we hope you learned something this trip here in the Midside. Listen to all the past shows from the past 6 seasons as we go into our 7th season at themidside.com/podcast. Or on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, where you can give us a 5-star rating that helps us move up the ladder there. That's much appreciated. Also, themidside.com/store, where you can get your Midside swag, including t-shirts. You can join on Discord, something-something Discord. Go back and listen to the previous parts of the episode to learn about that, because I don't know. And then patreon.com/themidside, where you can give us a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content. It helps us keep the lights on, really helps us pay for hosting and advertising and some other things. So that would be greatly, greatly appreciated. We love our Patreon subscribers. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating this show still for some unknown reason. And if you can't do any of that, tell a friend. It's 2019. 2019, make it a little better by sharing the show with your loved ones, or your hated ones, or the people to whom you're indifferent. Really anyone. Just share the show. We need more Midsiders. Until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Oh, 2019. Daniel,
I actually have a question for you, something funny that happened today. So your wife sent me a Patriots meme, and I was like, so the first thing is I got a message this morning on Facebook from your wife, and it was like, Fiza sent an attachment. I was like, did Fiza get hacked? She never
thought it was spam. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I looked at it, and it was like, this is a baby elephant. It's the biggest baby on the planet besides Patriots haters. And I was like, all right. And then she... talk to me a little bit about the Super Bowl, and then she was like, yeah, last year's defense was really disappointing. And I was like, what? Did she come to that independently, or did she just listen to you? And I don't mean to denigrate her, but I was just like, what?
She's all in this year. She is so excited. So it's going to be a family Super Bowl affair this year.
See, it's different. It's different this year.
It is different this year. Have a year.